I'm Christine Dean, and this is live from Studio A. And we are very happy to be welcoming back to our studios one of Duluth's most, I don't know how to describe you guys, but one of Duluth's most celebrated bands, maybe? One of Duluth's
favorite bands. One of Duluth's bands.
One of Duluth's most persistent bands.
I like that. Yeah. I like that. It's Low, and it's Al Sparhawk, Mimi Parker, and we also have Steve Garrington here with no microphone. He never wants to talk, but that's okay. And we're really happy to have you guys in.
Hey, thanks.
And partly because we missed the opportunity last year to have you in when it was actually your 20th anniversary as a band.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how that happened.
I don't know.
The beer is gone already.
Yeah. So now you're in your 21st year as a band or something.
Yeah, I guess 21. 21's the lucky number.
But then you guys decided to do this 7-week series at Fitger's Brewhouse where you are going through your entire catalog, song by song, in random order. And you're doing that over 7 weeks. We're in what, week 5 now?
Yeah, this is week 5 of 7 Thursdays, I guess. It's kind of an idea we've been sitting on for a few years, actually. We kind of thought it'd be interesting to try to do somehow like revisit our whole catalog and do some sort of extreme performance or something like that. And it just kind of keeps adding up, more and more songs. But, this opportunity came up to do kind of a series of Thursdays. We're off the road and home mostly for the winter here. And, I don't know, the math seemed about right. We had about 170 or so songs that we've recorded and over the years, and I guess the idea to play them all takes about, it's about two hours plus each Thursday, and I don't know. Yeah, it's fun. It's a challenge to revisit songs that are, some of them are pretty old, some of them I think naturally there's songs that you record sometimes you don't end up playing live very much and you sort of lose touch from them. There we go. I've just gotten the signal to shut my mouth. Go ahead.
No, to get closer to the microphone.
I was hinting for you to get closer to the microphone.
She's helping me out there.
All right.
But you're doing okay.
I'm as close as I can get to this microphone.
You're doing great.
People can't hear me.
You're doing great.
Should turn it up.
So I was reading that you actually, so the way that you approach this is on Sundays, you have a bag or box or something that has all the songs in it, and you just pick them out randomly. Is that how that works?
Yeah. Yeah, we cut them all up and print it out and cut them all up in little pieces of paper and threw them in a bag. And
I'd say the first two shows were very random. And then we started to look at our list, and at least I personally thought, I don't know, we better space some of these things out because it could be a really long, slow night if we played a certain selection.
I don't know. We haven't had to. For the most part,
it's been pretty random.
There'll be about two or three songs, and we'll say like, "Oh, okay, well." Mim's not singing any songs or there's too many songs that Mim's singing or something like that. And we'll kind of adjust a little bit, but for the most part, it's been as they have come out of the bag, that order, so to speak. We'll have a few days to learn them up and, remember the ones that we need to.
And Mimi, you had said to me at some point that you actually were surprised at how many of them you still do.
Yeah. I think we have a pretty good selection that we still play. Whenever we have a new record out, we go heavy on new songs, but we always mix up the old ones. And so, yeah, it's kind of nice to realize that.
Yeah.
That they stand up. Is there anything uncomfortable about doing that, about revisiting some of that early stuff? Had you spent much time doing that before?
A little bit, yeah. Actually, a number of years ago, this promoter in England started doing these Don't Look Back. It's the Don't Look Back series, which basically would have bands come and do a show where they would play just a specific record. So there have been two or three shows over the years where we have been requested to play like Things We Lost in the Fire or
Great Destroyer,
those sort of things. So sort of the process and the sort of the experience of going back and revisiting stuff that maybe isn't necessarily part of your psyche at that moment sort of isn't new to us, but so we've had a little bit of experience with that. And then just like Mim said, I mean, we kind of always were, I think a lot of times you're on tour and after about three or four shows of playing songs that you sort of know, you start going, okay, let's mix in something. You start, there's part of you that kind of craves that little edge of, are we sure we know this song? Or, you know, there's kind of a little bit of a thrill in playing something new that you are not completely, you know, familiar with. You
it's
know?
Safe to say there's a handful that we've never played live.
Yeah, there were
so we're a few, figuring it out and, you know, trying to make it work. But just that's kind of fun.
And you have a new band member since some of these were recorded, so he kind of has to start from scratch.
Yeah, it's safe to say Steve knows them better than we do because he's done his homework. We're kind of slacking here.
Well, let's hear a song, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more. What do you guys want to play here? Now, and also, maybe this perception is wrong, but are you kind of like, you kind of like to unveil the playlist at the show each time? So we don't necessarily want to give anything away.
Yeah, we kind of like to keep it pretty secret. We'll let out little hints sometimes to specific people we know.
Well,
who
yeah,
are
and we
for
have had
songs.
A couple specific requests, like people coming from
a long ways,
and
for
we
just
will.
One of the nights.
We haven't been that, you know, difficult to get along. I mean, we're accommodating to some people.
We'll take bribes.
yeah, there you go.
All
well,
right.
I don't know. We could kill two birds with one stone here. This is a song from the record that came out recently, and it's a song we're playing tonight. Plastic Cup. Plastic cup.
That is Low, live from Studio A, and a song from their most recent album, The Invisible Way. That was Plastic Cup. I love that concept of someone finding that cup 1,000 years from now. Where did that come from?
I've kind of always been fascinated with archaeology. I know it's an extremely boring and unappreciated profession in reality, but I don't know. Maybe it's just from being a kid and looking through National Geographic. I think my favorite ones were articles were the ones where they had dug up something or they'd found something on the bottom of the sea, and sort of the remnants and the fragments that are used to then extrapolate sort of assumptions about who the people were and what they did and what those objects meant and then sort of the idea of what will be left of us and what people will think of the objects left behind and how they'll interpret it, you know, kind of how they'll make assumptions about who we were.
And then that raises the question of how far off are we about the assumptions that we've made about...
Right, right. or just how far off we are.
And the other thing, and that's one aspect of that song, and then the other aspect of that song is it seems just very pointed, like a very pointed message to someone, you know, maybe a general person or a specific person, I don't know, but that seems kind of unusual.
Yeah, it's a little bit, it's talking to a friend or yourself, and obviously some sort of illicit situation has gone down, and sort of how life changes once they tag you.
And I love the closing line, write your own damn song and move on.
Yeah. it's kind of an aging songwriter's lament.
Oh yeah. So since you played one from that last album, and we haven't had you in since you put that out, let's talk about that a little bit. Your most recent album, The Invisible Way, first of all, where did the name come from? Why did you decide to name it that?
Well, Mim came up with that. You know, sometimes the title is obvious. You know, sometimes you know the title of the record even as you're driving to go make it. But this time... title came as we were making it. Mim just started writing phrases down on a notebook, and when she wrote down in Invisible Way, I think it was the list was done, and it sort of made sense to me. Sort of sometimes you feel the hand kind of holding you through things, and you see things that often are random fall on your side of the fence, and it's just kind of it's okay to acknowledge that something higher might be moving in your life, and the fact that it's invisible and that it's moving forward, and you know, it's okay. You can step forward without knowing necessarily how far down the cliff is.
Well, and it ties in with, you know, the Holy Ghost is one of the songs on the album, and it talks about, I feel the hands, but I don't see anyone. So it kind of fits in with that song and that concept.
That's probably the most literal, lyrical reference to that, maybe.
And the album was produced by Jeff Tweedy of Wilco, and first time he's produced something for you, is that right?
Yeah, it was pretty fun. We had met those guys years ago via Nels Klein, who plays guitar with him. We've known him for years, and he's a good friend and really just a generous and sweet person, and he kind of brought us into their circle, and we played some shows and tours with them, and became friends, and Jeff invited us out to the studio. They sort of have their own warehouse studio where they've done things for years, and Jeff has started to record people, other people, and I don't know. We had to stop by there and see it to believe it, and it, but it was definitely, it definitely was the selling point. You know, it's good vibe, and he's got a this engineer named Tom Schick who he's been working with for a while, who was really great. It was really a rare and really, really special opportunity to be able to work with him as well.
You guys have worked with so many different producers along the way. You kind of change it up every time. What do different people bring to the project, and why have you always chosen to kind of do something different?
Well, I mean, it varies. I mean, everybody we've worked with, it's different, and there's different reasons and stuff. But I don't know. I think I like working with producers. It's sort of a combination of trust and the unknown. You know, you're it really is helpful to have someone else kind of whether it's just perspective or some other entity even that just keeps you in check as an artist. You know, sometimes they don't even have to say anything. You know, I mean, working with Albini, like Steve Albini, he was not necessarily someone that was telling us what to do or how to do things or saying, "Oh, that was a great take, do it again." It was more just we had this huge respect for him. He's a very knowledgeable engineer and an outspoken, you know, voice for artists, and just I think having that standard there, I think pushed us, as you know, when we were working with him, you know, we've worked with people like Dave Fridman, who's fairly famous working with Flaming Lips. More recently, MGMT and Tame Impala, and he is more of a hands-on guy. He was coming up; he was helping us come up with sounds and really taking the mix to the limit. And working with someone like that, it was, you know, like I said, it was sort of this, we had this huge respect for him, and I trusted that he, you know, would take what we were doing and shine it in the right way, that, you know, or take it further in a way that that we had confidence with. And I don't know, I guess coming I guess short story finally coming up with Jeff Tweedy again, it was a matter of respect, you know, understanding where he's coming from. You know, here's a guy who's made a lot of records, he's written a lot of songs and sung a lot of takes. You know, and I think that's a lot of what he was bringing there, is sort of a level of professionality and sort of a little bit of mentor kind of thing going on. You know, kind of encouraging us, gave us a little bit of cheerleading going on, a little bit of, you know, that was great, do it again. You know, walking through the vocal takes was really interesting with him, because he's someone who's been on that side of the mic and gone through his phrasing and trying to get, you know, it's a very meticulous thing sometimes, and it can be very it's a very intimate but very helpful thing to have someone kind of in the other room on the headphones with you, kind of talking through that and helping you get the best, just helping you present what you have in the best way. And so I don't know, hopefully that's not too rambly, but yeah, I mean, producing can be many things, I guess.
Is there anybody in that list? I actually opened up to Facebook, said, "Hey, I'm going to have low end. You guys have any questions?" And somebody wanted to know who your favorite producer was. So I guess I was thinking of that in terms of all those, that list of people, who would you might maybe be interested in working with again? Or
they're all great. I mean, we have. I don't know. I mean, it'd be great to work with Jeff again. Matt Beckley is a really, really amazing mixer and engineer and producer, and I think it'd be fun to work with him again. Fridman's great. We run into Steve Albini from time to time, and he's sweet. It'd be fun to work with him again.
In other words, no comment.
No, I can't.
Yeah, how do you?
I think to pick a favorite, we would make more enemies than friends, probably.
Well, and you've been doing more producing of your own lately, Al. So what have you taken? Because you've worked with so many different styles and different people. What have you taken from that? Do you kind of take the best from each one when you approach producing, or what do you do? Or just do it your own way?
You can kind of do it your own way. Obviously, sensitive to who you're working with. I guess specifically what you're talking about, I've done a few things with some people in town. Actual Wolf helped him with a couple of records, mostly a lot of just the tracking and kind of working with his band and you know, getting his little bit of working on his songs with him and stuff, and then he has taken that and kind of run with it. Worked with Snowbarn, did the record that came out earlier this year, last year. That was fun, sort of a similar thing, just walking them through takes and their songs and just kind of cheerleading, you know, kind of help them get the best they can of what they have. The Charlie Parr record that just came out recently was really fun. You know, and I mean, nobody really produces Charlie necessarily. You get out of the way and let him do what he does. So that was fun. That was more just setting up a couple mics and keeping my mouth shut and letting him do what he did.
Did I hear that you were working with Trampled by Turtles recently?
Yeah.
I mean, I
yeah.
know you guys have collaborated with them on some stuff before. But.
Yeah, that's sort of some news. It's just we're sort of just getting the okay to let out.
It was in the newspaper. That's where
I
read it.
Yeah,
so.
I think they must have got the okay from the managers. But, well, I kind of didn't want to. Yeah, I didn't want to jump the gun because maybe they didn't like maybe they wouldn't like what they did with me, and they'd end up doing someone else. But so far, it looks like they're sticking with what we did. But yeah, last month, the Turtles, Trampled by Turtles, and I, and this engineer producer named BJ Burton, got together and tracked their record, and we mixed it. Sort of the last couple of weeks, we've been finalizing it, and it's been really fun. That was a really great experience. I really enjoyed that, and it was really an honor to have those guys as trust enough to let me come in and tell them what to do on a couple things, but mostly just sit back and give them the room and the time to do what they do. And so I'm really happy with how it turned out, and unfortunately, we'll have to wait until probably summer before it comes out. But it was fun.
When did the actual work happen? When did you actually work on it with them?
Top of January.
Oh, okay.
Week or two actually down at Pachyderm Studio south of St. Paul.
Okay. All right. Well, Steve looks like he's drifting off over there, so we're going to do another song.
He's researching.
No, whenever Steve is in here, whether he's with Actual Wolf or with you guys, I think he just likes looking at the music library. So he's a music fan. Like, he's actually a big music fan. So what do you guys want to play next?
Wow. Should we step further back in time a little bit? Should we do what's the one?
Tonight
or? Oh, okay. Mim's going to do one. It's called Tonight.
We'll do Tonight Today. Thank you.
That is Lo live from Studio A with Tonight. And which I'm forgetting which album that's off. Which album is that from? Oh, good. I don't feel so
trust.
Bad.
It's on Trust, I think.
On Trust. So, Mimi, you sang on that one, which reminded me that on the new album, there was kind of a big deal. Oh, Mimi sings more songs on this one. Was that an intentional thing? It just turned out that way? Your voice just fit the songs better?
It was. Excuse me. It was kind of intentional. Alan has kind of been pushing that for a while. So, I guess the timing was right. I decided to write some songs, and so it all came together.
And some lovely ones. Just Make It Stop, was that one that you wrote?
Yeah, I
really enjoy that one.
Oh,
and I find myself when I'm feeling overwhelmed, it's that kind of that out of control feeling, and that's kind of how I see that song. Is that?
Yeah. That's Alan actually wrote the chorus for that, but he kind of came up with some of that line and some of it,
we were kind of joking. Like, just make it stop. Like, just make it stop.
So it was collaboration.
Oh, you said he's been pushing for it. So was it something you were reluctant to do?
I don't know. I guess I don't write as much as him, I guess, in general. So I knew that if it was going to, you know, if I was going to, I knew I was going to have to work. I was going to have to get work in, which is good. You know, it was good for me to, but it was just going to mean more time and more effort.
Is writing a kind of a torturous process for you? And I'm just, I think it is for some people.
I wouldn't say it's torturous, but it's just something you definitely have to decide to do. You know, I mean, it's very rare that something will just click, which happens sometimes, you know, something will fall together really easily, but other times it's kind of just a labor. You just have to work and work at it. And I kind of knew what I was in for, so I just thought, all right, let's see what happens.
So you kind of have to mentally prepare yourself, and then
maybe
you pay more attention to if a line comes to you or something. I mean, do you normally?
Yeah, no, I try to. If something comes to me, I'll write it down and, you know, see if it comes to anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think. You kind of have to get your brain to just do that. And then I think if you just do it every day, try a little bit, think about it, your brain will get used to it. It's pretty quickly will start responding and being able to go to that place on command, so to speak, if you just kind of do it a little bit every day. And it is. It's work. I mean, if you kind of just wait around for things to happen, it usually isn't going to come together. But I don't know. It's definitely worth it. It seems sort of meticulous and cold to be like, okay, you know, you have to actually create a work ethic for writing. Mm-hmm. But the work ethic is the framework by which then the creative moments happen. I mean, when those happen, that's undeniable. I mean, and without that framework and that sort of frame to let it appear upon, it's not going to happen.
I'm always happy when I hear artists say that, because I think sometimes people feel like, well, I'm not a creative person. I can't, you know, I don't spontaneously have all these ideas coming up. And then you have somebody come in who is, you know, a talented person, and they say, I work at it. You know, it's not just, you know, you get some inspiration from somewhere, but you also have a discipline almost.
Yeah, and I mean, it's maybe unfair to call it work. It's more just doing it. You do it. You sit down and say, "Is there anything in there?" And you write it down, and it could be the stupidest thing ever, but write it down. And the next day, do that again. What do I got? Okay, write down this stupid line that comes to your mind. The fourth or fifth day, you're going to come up with two lines, or you're going to come up with a line that's pretty good. And if you hadn't done that the first three or four days, you wouldn't have gotten there. I really insist. I mean, I think everybody has that muscle in their brain. It's just a matter of waking it up and letting it work a little bit. I mean, whatever you like, whether it's writing stuff or making up this with music or literature or painting or whatever, I mean, you just spend a little time. You tell your... You know, you open that little door, and that door will get bigger and bigger and bigger every day, and pretty soon it'll be just a very natural friend that you can go to, you know, and it will pay you back multitude.
A lot of times I think it's just kind of telling yourself that you can do it. We've got a 13-year-old, almost 14, and she's been composing songs on the piano that are really, just really creative and really great. And I think, you know, she's just seen us writing songs, and this is what we do. And I think she's never been told she couldn't do it, and she's never thought, oh, I can't do this. She's just seen us do it, and, you know, as an example, and it's like, wow, well, they can do
people
it,
do
I
this.
Guess. Yeah, this is what people do
this,
and
so
people are creative.
Okay, do it.
So, yeah.
That is part of the secret, is just shutting off that negative
voice. That voice, yeah.
That,
yeah.
Sometimes that's the hardest part for people.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, since you mentioned your daughter, I had read somewhere you guys recently covered Rihanna's Stay, and I read that was inspired by your son's taste in music. Is that true? And
yeah.
I want to know, like, what having those aged children, how does that affect the music that you hear and are exposed to?
I think I have to admit the kids have definitely have opened the door to, mm-hmm. yeah, you know, they
the
like
bus,
the top.
They listen to
that stuff, and our son for some reason just absorbs that stuff, and he knows all the songs and all the things, and so they'll listen at the house from time to time, and every once in a while you'll hear a tune, like, oh, that's interesting, and you get a little bit of a sense of who's out there and who's knocking on the top 10, and you know you hear little snippets and the news about different people, so you sort of can make that connection. You realize, oh, okay, this is who Kanye is, this is who Beyonce is, this is who, you know, Macklemore, and some of these people that you hear about at the Grammys, etc. And it's interesting. Some of them are very talented, and there's always a little bit of a thread that you can hear in top 40 radio of something really creative, either that they're either copying something someone did really amazing and really broke some new ground with a couple of years ago, or there's just something perverse enough that kind of is, if you have a pretty wide perception of music and listen to lots of different kinds of things, there's always going to be something that'll be interesting things. You'll see, like, wow, this song's really interested by influenced by reggaeton or different influences of world music or things that are, I don't know, I guess I'm just rambling, but it is interesting, and for sure Rihanna is pretty talented. That song's really strong,
yes.
And she's just a great, great singer, and that one just kind of stood out because it's just basically piano and bass and vocal, a really great vocal. So.
By Mimi. I'm going to talk again about the series that you're doing, because there were a couple other things that I was wondering about. First of all, has it been a while since you've played for a bar crowd? I was wondering, as I was standing up in front with the hushed, reverent people, but hearing all of the non-hushed drinking mm-hmm. people in the back, I was thinking, I wonder if it's been a long time since they've exposed themselves to this sort of atmosphere.
I don't know. You know, that seems to always kind of rear its head just when we don't. Just when we think we're doing pretty well and do a few theater shows where people are sitting down in real nice places, and then we'll play some places or some festival where people are just loud. But I don't know. We lived through way worse, you know, in our early years as far as apathetic audiences. And I mean, I don't know. I try to tell other people who run into that problem that, you know, that just always remember you can't hear the people that are listening. You know, it only takes about 3 or 4 loud drunk people to make it feel like the whole place is completely turned on you. But don't worry, man. People just live in their lives, and if it's coming out the speakers, then people can hear what you're doing, and it's fine.
No, go for it, Mimi.
Kind of fun to just kind of barrel through it. It's a little humbling. You're just, okay, you know, we're...
just a band.
We're just a band, and we're just
playing
in
the corner.
Because some of these songs...
You're only as
older,
good as your songs in a room, you know?
Some of these songs are pretty quiet. And sometimes you just feel like you're singing for yourself in that room. But no.
Does it kind of give you flashbacks to when you were first starting out?
Well, there was nobody at those shows, so
so it was a lot quieter.
Yeah.
Just your quiet music in a quiet space. Well, on that note, I was thinking tell me about your very first show ever. Where and when was that?
Well, it was down on First Street and about 18th East at a place called Recyclabel. This is 93, I suppose. Spring of 93, we were on a bill with four or five other local bands that were sort of around that time. Bands, mostly underage bands, were playing at this place. It was sort of a squat. It's the old Bell building that some people owned for a while that were letting people come in and do meetings and charity things, and then kids were doing shows. And I don't know, we played only three or four songs, and it was really quiet. You know, we were very quiet and small sounding, and there were a few people in the front that really got into it, and
just enough to encourage us to keep
doing
it.
Just enough to encourage us to think that maybe there was some hope. But yeah, I don't know. We knew we were doing something a little challenging, at least for that time. But we kind of felt something in it, and figured if there were a couple people that felt the same thing, that we were onto something.
It's kind of funny because the first show was the Recyclabel, and honestly, I think the fourth show was the Knitting Factory. In Manhattan.
I think the third show.
Maybe the third or fourth.
Really?
Yeah.
How did that progression happen so quickly?
Well, remember, these were different times, you know, in the early 90s. You know, a lot of, you know, businesses were, you know, companies were really excited about new music. You know, some indie bands had broke, or some alternative or whatever it was called at that time had broke big. And people were still buying CDs and tapes and stuff, and
we were recording with Kramer. Kramer set up the show.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. We did our show, our first show. It went well. We demoed our two or three songs, and I sent a cassette to this guy who produced bands out in New York. You know, he produced bands that I liked, some obscure stuff, and he invited us out and
set up
that
a show.
Sort of,
yeah.
Yeah, we recorded. He set up a show for us, and I don't know. Yeah, kind of went on from there. It was sort of a couple lucky breaks early on, and we were able to get a record out and sort of go out and give it a shot.
And when did Steve enter the band? I'm going to talk about him
Years ago.
So the one question I wanted to ask you, Steve, if you get over that microphone, what was your first show? Tell me about your first low show and what that experience was like.
That I played? Or?
Yep, that you played.
Oh,
well, sure,
that's fine, too. We were Kirby Rafters.
Okay.
That was my first show with the band.
Yeah? Yeah. And how did it go? How did you feel?
Great. I'm still here, right?
How did Steve end up getting into the band?
Well, Steve's from... Well, he's from Ashland, but he'd been living in Duluth and playing in bands off and on. And, you know, friends of friends. You hang out with a guy after a while and see him shred on the bass. And you want that. You want that in your life.
We dropped everything and said, that's the guy.
That's the guy.
I don't care what's going on. We need that guy.
See the future. No, I mean, well, I don't know. I mean... It's sort of no secret we've been through a few bass players over the years and had a lot of great experiences with all of them, but yeah, Steve's been
there.
Really good. He's
we needed him.
He's a UWS alumni, and you can't argue with that.
Steve
says to move on.
Yeah, all right. Let's hear another one. What do you guys want to play for us next?
The Holy Ghost.
Yeah, okay.
Want to do that? Which one? Try to see? All right. All right, this is from the record previous to the recent one. It's called Try to Sleep. The record's called Come On. Thank you.
That's Low, live from Studio A with a song from their Come On album. And I heard you play a couple of those in the set last Thursday night. Or was it the first one that I went to? Anyway, one of them. And that album is really like kind of stands out, kind of shiny and sunny quality to it. Although the lyrics are still, you know, kind of dark. But
That one's kind of a positive record.
It just has that sound to it, and it kind of, when I hear it in the context of some of your other stuff.
Oh, right on, cool.
Might have been the Beckley touch.
Might have been Beckley. It's the John Stamos factor.
The John Stamos factor, who was in one of the videos. Yeah. That video, right? Was it for that song?
Yeah,
That's right. So another thing about revisiting your catalog, I was interested in something that you said the first night that I went to one of those shows, Al. And you said that in doing that, you kind of discover that you write certain categories of songs that you write.
Right, yeah.
Is that a weird thing to discover when you're revisiting your work? And what are those categories?
Well, I don't know. I think over time, I guess writing songs for quite a while, you start seeing habits in yourself and... You know, you spend a lot of time trying to avoid them and edit around them, but I find there's over the years there's definitely some. I don't know. I mean, they wouldn't all fall in those categories.
Oh,
I don't know.
Of course not. But you kind of gave you have like some Roy Orbison
I have some songs that have kind of this thing about Roy Orbison and sort of his songs that was sort of start and this sort of majestic stride that they kind of go forward and they build and build and build and then reach this peak and then they end, you know, I kind of get a lot of songs like that, Will the Night, Stars Gone Out,
Little Argument
with Myself, the different things like that. I have sort of these three chord circular ones, sort of like the first song that we did, you know, like that. And then I read a lot kind of around that sort of pattern, and then these kind of plodding songs that are usually kind of like one note, you know, like, oh, the soldiers, they're all gonna die, you know, just real kind of plodding, heavy,
cheerful.
Yeah, real cheerful, you know.
party songs.
Some sort of thing apparently I had to get off of my chest, and then there's sort of country gospel kind of things. Maybe we'll do Holy Ghost. It's sort of I've kind of always been very aware of kind of steering clear of too much Americana, too much kind of surrendering to country music kind of thing. But there's something about gospel and some sort of the edge of where blues and gospel kind of mutate into folk music that it's sort of always fascinated with me. And it's in many ways it's a lot more free and open and it's sort of a vibe that you can go to and feel like it's your own without necessarily feeling like you're drawing on something that everybody's been hearing for decades, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's inevitable that, you know, everybody kind of has their own patterns that they fall into. And,
sure.
But I think that you seem like you constantly are challenging yourself and you do so many different things. You have a blues band, you have, you know, you're in, Murder of Crows with Galen.
Galen White,
and that's kind of a different sort. You know, she's playing fiddle. You did the thing with Charlie Parr. You know, you guys have collaborated with Trampled by Turtles. So it kind of seems like you're always kind of looking for ways to challenge yourself, change up what you're doing.
Yeah, why not? You know, I mean, we've been really lucky. We were able to do music, travel around. We've been able to see lots of different things, and we've been part of a community that for long enough that we know a lot of people here, and we've kind of been able to see things happen over the years and make friends and be influenced by people in this community and collaborate with them. I mean, it's how we started the band, and it's sort of natural that you you draw on the good from your friends and try to contribute back. But I don't know. I think anyone who's spent a little time with music, you know, whether you're a fan or playing it or whatever, you realize that there's lots of different styles of music, and there's lots of really great things and diverse styles. And then the older you get, I feel really lucky that stuff still surprises me. You still discover things that you hadn't thought or you hadn't heard before, and stuff that's been around for a long time that maybe you didn't think to look at. And I don't know. I think you always come away learning something, and you always feel like you've been sort of edified by that spirit. But I don't know. I mean, I to me, it's just natural. I mean, of course, you'd want to try a lot of different stuff, you know, and we do. We, you know, luckily, most people don't hear about 90% of the stuff that I come up with. You know, hopefully, only the reasonable stuff leaks out. But yeah, it's part of being in this town.
Well, we have time for one more song. What do you guys... Oh, you're going to do Holy Ghost, you said?
Yeah, let's do Holy Ghost.
Which was covered by Mavis Staples. How did that feel?
Well, it was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're big Mavis Staples fans. I've had this compilation of a bunch of 50s singles, kind of some really early recordings that they did in the 50s, and is really one of the dear, it's very, very dear to my heart. If a piece of plastic could be such, it's really, yeah. The Staple Singers are pretty special, and to have her hear and like enough to play our song. I mean, it was a little bit of an inside job. Jeff Tweedy produced this new record of hers, and I think he was looking for songs for her to try and played this one for her. So... And she liked it. But yeah, it's a huge honor. All right, everybody have a great day. It's called Holy Ghost. Mim's going to sing it. And wish we could give you all hugs. Here we go.
Holy Ghost.
Beautiful. That is Low live from Studio A, and one from their latest album, The Invisible Way. Well, thank you so much, guys. Just one more thing, and well, actually a couple more things. One, how did it feel to be in the front row at that tribute Duluth does Low a few months ago? You seemed like you got pretty emotional about that, Alan.
Yeah, well, it was everything you'd expect. I mean, having your friends sing your songs back to you was...
It was really, really sweet, and I loved every single performance.
Yeah, every single performance was so beautiful and creative.
And it was really, really great.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think people deserve to be flattered that much, but if it does happen, rest assured, it's a really great, humbling feeling. It was fun. It's sort of like This Is Your Life meets... Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And you probably don't have to do it again for another 20 years, so.
I hope not.
Key to the City was something special, though. You can probably actually chop things on that.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
That the mayor presented you with.
Yeah, that was pretty great.
And then just quickly, I also wanted to mention, because it just happened, the Drone Not Drones thing, was that just this past weekend?
Yeah, I guess this last week.
Okay.
It was an event in Minneapolis.
When you guys, you know, for people that might not know, last year you did this Rock the Garden thing, and you had like a 25-28 minute set or something, and you decided to do something experimental, thinking, hey, that's, you know, that people will love it. And then a bunch of people were complaining, which I actually kind of find it, maybe it's a sign that you've made it when people are mad that you didn't play your hits. You know, Low didn't play their hits.
I don't know that. Yeah, it was weird. It was interesting. It's kind of a long.
But you ended the, you did this experimental thing and you ended it with saying drone not drones, and then you know. There was a big to-do about it. But there's actually, Drone Not Drones is actually an organization, right?
Well, there's a guy in Minneapolis named Luke Hyken who actually invented the slogan, and it was sort of a, you know, sort of a play on sort of a genre of music that is drone music, sort of repetitive, kind of long music, and it's sort of referring then to it's basically anti-drone missile sentiment. When we did this piece, it was sort of this thing at Rock the Garden. It was sort of a long, extended drone. We thought it'd be really cool because the sun was coming out from behind the clouds and stuff. But it was blame it on instant media or something. But it sort of became an argument.
Was for Doctors Without Borders. So
yeah. It was, anyway, you went on to
some hours of.
It was 28 hours. Of continuous drone.
Continuous drone, yeah.
So it was really great to be part of it.
Yeah, it was a charity event in Minneapolis this last weekend.
Mm-hmm. And they liked it. And we were happy to say that people did not get angry at us.
People didn't get angry at that one.
Well, and that's kind of what the point I was trying to make was that it, you know, it kind of turned out into this really positive thing.
Yeah.
And it's benefited Doctors Without Borders,
yes.
Doctors
right.
Against Borders. And so that's a pretty darn cool thing. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you so
right,
much,
thanks.
You guys. And I want to say a personal thank you. Just for the many years that I've enjoyed your music and the many beautiful moments that I have spent at your shows. And just thank you. I very much appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Christine.
And you've always been very generous with us here at KMD. And we actually want to do something for you. So Emma and my friend Aaron is here. And Aaron is a big Low fan. And she made cake.
Oh, my goodness.
She made 20th anniversary cake for Low. Not just one, but two.
People could see
oh,
this.
My goodness. Wow.
There will be pictures.
That
so,
is wow.
We just want to say thank you. And we hope you like cake.
Oh, beautiful carrot cake here and then a chocolate cake.
Well, you know, you guys are pretty healthy, so we beautiful. Thought, well, we better make sure at least one of them is, you know, has vegetables in it or something.
Wow, thank you. This is amazing.
All right.
Today's live from Studio A was produced by me, Christine Dean, with help from Cameron Flackty. To check out upcoming guests or to listen to previous sessions, go to KUMD.org and click on Arts. This is live from Studio A on 103.3 KUMD. Thanks for listening.